This program was first broadcast on Canterbury's community access radio station Plains FM 96.9 and was made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Coming up next, conversations on human rights with Speak Up, Kōrero Tia, here on Plains FM.
E nā mana, e nā reo, e nā hō e whā. Tēnā koutou katoa. No mai ki tēne hōtaka. Speak Up, Kōrero Tia. Tune in as our guests Speak Up, sharing their unique and powerful experiences and opinions. And may you also be inspired to speak up when the moment's right. Nō mai ki te hōtaka, tika tanga to Speak Up Kōrero Tia. This is Sally Carlton, your host. So it's 2020, 75 years since the end of World War II, and with it, the liberation of the Nazi death camps. Quite interestingly, I feel like there's been very little about this year, given what's been going on. And I have to say, I was very embarrassed and shocked at myself to realise that I had missed the anniversary of the 75 years in May this year. So I guess that's part of what we're going to be talking about now, is what's been going on with the current state of affairs and how this is impacting on the past. Today we're going to be talking about Holocaust awareness and the flip side of that, Holocaust non-awareness, I suppose, or even denial. So it's a hugely important topic, one that we haven't yet broached on Speak Up Kōrero Tia, so it's good to have with us two guests today, Chris Clancy from the Holocaust Centre of New Zealand and Jacqueline Lichner, who is Associate Professor at the Victoria University of Wellington. If you guys could both introduce yourselves, tell a little bit about your work and why you're engaged in the panel today.
My name is Chris Clancy. I'm the Education Director. The reason why I do this work is the importance of it. I was a history teacher in the United States, and I saw that my students often would never make the connections of history to today, because too often we teach history as being an event that's done and over with, that there's no lasting effects. And yes, it's 75 years ago that the camps were liberated, but there are still survivors alive today that are living with the scars of those events, and they're second and third generation that get passed down with those memories. And that informs and shapes everything that they do. And it informs and shapes how we react as a society to things today that are going on.
Tēnā koe, Sally. Kia ora, Chris, and tēnā koutou to the listeners. So I am, as you said, Associate Professor of History at Victoria University of Wellington. I teach Holocaust history here, also propaganda, and I'm a specialist in memory and representation, in particular film representation of what we might call the long Second World War, so the Holocaust, but also the kind of run-up to the Second World War, which really in Europe includes the whole of the interwar period from the rise of fascism and Nazism onwards. And I have been involved also with the Holocaust Centre of New Zealand for a few years, serving on its board. So also really interested in the sort of public commemoration and awareness and perception of the Holocaust.
So given that we are talking about what is the Holocaust, it might be great just to start off with what is the Holocaust? And obviously that is a massive question.
That is a very big question, because, I mean, how do you define the timing of the Holocaust as well? As Giacomo mentioned, teaching, you know, the rise of fascism, a lot of historians could point to that as being the start of it, the rise of anti-Semitism in Europe and things like that. In general, most people would say the Holocaust is the mass murder of over 6 million Jews by Nazi Germany and collaborators, not just in camps, which is what most people know, but also through starvation in ghettos and killing fields in Eastern Europe.
So it's important to understand the Holocaust as this sort of growth that starts with disenfranchisement in the 30s in Europe, and then discrimination and persecution and physical persecution all the way to extermination. And while historians refer to the Holocaust as the genocide of European Jews, it's also important to understand it more broadly in a context in which other groups were targeted by the Nazis and their collaborators, either for extermination, groups like the Roma or Gypsies and the disabled, or for persecution on the basis of ethnicity, political ideas, religious beliefs, or sexual orientation.
Do we have some kind of stats? So you've mentioned 6 million Jews. What are kind of the total numbers there as well?
These are estimates, including the 6 million. Different historians come up with different ranges. The 6 million in relation to the Jews comes from the closest figures by Lucy Davidovich, writing in the 70s or 80s, I can't quite recall, but she comes up with a really granular figure of 5,933,900 Jewish people based on pre-war census records, other pre-war records. Wolfgang Benz more recently puts it in a much broader range between 5.3 and 6.2, but now 6 million has become a sort of convention. The other group, the largest other group, was actually probably Soviet POWs, who were treated not like other POWs because of the Nazi racism towards Slavs and their ideological aversion towards communists. And so about 3.3 million Soviet POWs died in captivity out of a total of 5.7 million. So that's a huge percentage, especially if you compare it to how many casualties there were amongst British or American POWs. Then there's non-Jewish Polish civilians, also persecuted widely, in a less organized way, in a less systematic way, but nevertheless very widely. And there's about 1.9 million of those civilians of Polish nationality, but not Jewish. Researchers in Washington at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum estimate about 100,000 gay men arrested in Germany and the occupied countries. About 5 to 15,000 of those died in concentration camps. 220,000 Roma or Romani, and commonly and perhaps inaccurately referred to as gypsies. That's about a quarter of the entire population in Europe. They were gassed. They were the other group to be gassed alongside Jews. And then, of course, there's 200,000 victims of the T4 programs, normally referred to as the euthanasia campaigns. Of course, they're nothing to do with euthanasia. They're murder campaigns that the Nazis carried out against both German and Polish disabled, both adults and children.
Yeah, the numbers are really staggering, aren't they? They're almost...
It's incomprehensible.
Yeah, it is.
To understand 6 million, 200,000, 1.5 million, the numbers are just incomprehensible to the human mind.
Mm. We've recently had in Christchurch the 1.5 million buttons exhibition, and you think 1.5 million, that's such a huge number, but I think the idea behind the buttons being that actually you can see that kind of tangible visual part of it, trying to make it that little bit more comprehensible.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, Sally, that the choice of the buttons as an object was inspired by the Moriah School children and their teachers, because they carry the individuality. Each button is different, but while also conveying the mass and the collectivity. I think compared to another really impressive example in the US, I think Chris will be familiar with this, of the paperclips.
Yep.
They collected 6 million paper clips, and while that really conveyed the volume, it probably missed something in terms of individuality, because the paper clips are all the same.
One of the things about memorializing the Holocaust and genocide in general is balancing the understanding of the gravity and the largeness of it along with the individual stories of the people involved. And too often when we're teaching it, we tend to focus on the facts that are very sterile and barren, because it can be very difficult and oftentimes too hard to do those individual stories, because they become so personal to us, even if we aren't related to it at all.
But yet so important in terms of actually giving a face and a story. I guess we're thinking about what's been going on this year as well to mark or not the 75th anniversary. Was there much that took place? I know there were things that were planned that obviously had to be cancelled or at least toned down a lot. And what has the impact of that been on not being able to commemorate the 75th anniversary of the end of the war and the end of the death camps as had been anticipated or planned?
There was a lot planned. The big event would have been in May with VE Day. It was supposed to be in Canada this year to bring together all of the European nations, as well as all of the allied nations in America, Australia, Canada, places like that, to honor not just the liberation of the camps, but also the liberation of Europe. COVID has changed everything when it comes to how we commemorated it this year. It was a lot more subdued, and online was a lot of the commemorations that were done for Yom HaShoah, which is the Holocaust Remembrance Day for Israel. which tends to fall in the April-May area because it follows the Jewish calendar. We did a video montage and put that out online as our commemoration. I would say that how COVID affected everything, it kind of pushed everything to the side because that became the focus of how do we respond to this international crisis of this disease. But for those that are still around that are survivors, it also brought back a lot of personal memories of what they went through. Everyone knows Anne Frank being locked up for 2 years in her hiding place in the attic in Amsterdam. And a lot of people compared lockdown to what she went through. And there is no comparison. Understanding what those people went through, if they were in hiding or if they were in a ghetto, it just doesn't compare to what we went through. But it did bring back a lot of memories for those people that went through it about how horrible those times were. So I think that's something that we have to look at how we're going to deal with in the future as well as this continues to go on.
The mental health implications.
Yeah.
Giacomo, you mentioned right at the beginning when you were introducing the Holocaust, the idea that looking at the rise of fascism as being part of it and the fact that it went from, you know, a few comments to laws being enacted to persecution on a greater scale and eventually ending up in the death camps. And I think that this is a theme that we'll take through into our conversation. But it's not a snap of a fingers thing that you end up with a genocide. It is a progression. And as we're talking about Holocaust awareness and how important it is that people have this awareness that a large part of why the Holocaust was enabled was because people did not put up their hands and say, actually, this is not the right thing to do. So I think we might have our first song, but we'll bear that in mind as we move forward. Being a bystander versus being an upstander and the importance of taking on that moral responsibility. Giacomo, you've chosen our first song for us, which is Zognit Kemrol. I may have pronounced that wrong, sorry.
That's pretty good. Good Yiddish. Well done.
Thank you.
Zognit Kemrol is really in English, never say. It's also known as the Partisaner hymn or the hymn of the partisans. Normally, if you search it up, you'll see it referred to as the song of the Warsaw Ghetto. So in fact, it was written in Vilna Ghetto in Lithuania, another one of the major ghettos of Eastern Europe, the major Jewish communities of Eastern Europe. I chose it partly because it's a powerful song about resistance, but its lyrics are not triumphant. They really encapsulate well the desperate situation of those Jews in Eastern Europe who attempted to resist Nazism and Nazi persecution. Historically, there's been a lot of discussion, a lot of scholarship around Jewish resistance and what seems like the absence of Jewish resistance or Jewish passivity. In fact, Jewish resistance was everywhere, quite often physical armed resistance, but more often in all sorts of other ways that I wouldn't describe as passive resistance, like even just trying to maintain dignity in the face of dehumanization. So this song really encapsulates that, I think, and it's become, I think, an important song. But I chose a version, sadly, that was sung by Paul Robeson, the African-American civil rights activist. While it's not quite the most authentic version, I really like the story behind it, that he decided to use it as the encore in his 1949 concert in Moscow. It was a very important, politically very significant concert. He had gone there and found that many Jewish intellectuals that he had become friends with during his socialist activism in the 1930s and 40s had been imprisoned by Stalin and actually were awaiting execution. And that evening at the concert at the Tchaikovsky Theater, he sang this song as his encore. And it was a powerful statement against the Stalinist purges, but also, I think, a really wonderful and really resonant statement about the solidarity between oppressed peoples. Robeson's father had been a slave, and after being freed as a slave, he became a preacher, and he often used Hebrew texts and Hebrew language in his preachings. And so he had been raised to see the commonalities between the victims of oppression and prejudice.
Atahua, beautiful.
Namihi.
Never say that you have reached the very end, when leaden skies a bitter future may portend. For sure the hour for which we yearn will yet arrive.
brave, and our marching steps will thunder, we survive. For sure the hour for which we yearn will yet arrive, and our marching steps will thunder, we survive. Not late, but blood inscribes this bitter song we sing. 'Tis not a caroling of birds upon the wing, but 'twas a people midst the crashing fires of hell that sang this song and fought courageous till it fell. But 'twas a people midst the crashing fires of hell that sang this song and fought courageous till it fell. Sorgnit keen mal as du gehst dem letzten Weg, wenn himlen bleine verstellen bleue Teg, weil kommen wird noch unser Reus gebinte Schau, uns wird der Beugton, unser Trott mir seinen Da. Weil kommen wird noch unser Reus gebinte Schau, uns wird der Beugton, unser Trott mir seinen Da. Geschrieben ist das Lied mit Blut und nicht mit Blei. Es ist nicht ein Lied von unserem Vogel auf der Frei. Das hat ein Volk zwischen Talen dicker Wend. Das Lied gesungen mit einer Gammes in die Hand. Das hat ein Volk zwischen Talen dicker Wend. Das Lied gesungen mit einer Gammes in die Hand.
You're with Speak Up Cordero here, and today we're talking about Holocaust awareness with Chris Clancy and Jacqueline Wollichner. I'd like to think about now Holocaust awareness in New Zealand. There was a survey that was conducted in 2019 asking New Zealanders, randomly selected, about their knowledge of the Holocaust, and some of the findings are quite worrying. It would be great if you could talk us through the results, and then we'll have a discussion about what they might mean.
I can only speak from an American standpoint. I was not in New Zealand at the time when it was done. And Giacomo can correct me if I'm wrong. The New Zealand survey was done after a CNN survey showed that in America, Holocaust education that time was, and still is, very varied state to state because we don't have a national curriculum. And amongst children between the ages, I think it was 11 and 18, it's upwards of 30 to 35% don't know about the Holocaust. Coming from America and knowing those numbers and being a teacher in America when I was living there, it's terrifying. It's absolutely terrifying. It was a Jew that lived in the south of the United States, which if your listeners know anything about the south, you know, any kind of non-white Anglo-Saxon Protestant is generally not going to be the ones that are accepted into society. And knowing that a third of my students hadn't heard of this horrible time of history, regardless of any religious belief, it means that it can happen again and that it only takes one or two generations before we start forgetting. And that leads to a repetition of history, which we never want to see.
That's absolutely right. In terms of context, there was surveys not just in the US, but also in Austria, in France. And the European Union has been surveying not so much Holocaust awareness, but certainly anti-Semitism recently, because people are reacting to what they see on the ground, which is a rise in certainly in anti-Semitism and a rise in Holocaust denial through the internet and social media. As far as I'm aware, it was the first such awareness poll in New Zealand, and so it's a little hard to find any kind of trend. But I think it's concerning enough to suggest that I think the results say 28% were unsure about how much they knew, and 27% only knew a little. That's concerning enough to carry on polling Holocaust awareness so that we can discover trends, really. I think that would be the main takeaway. The thing that struck me of those results was around the question of whether the Holocaust is a myth. It was a very direct question, and so it's hard to argue that there was ambiguity or confusion. 4% answered yes, that the Holocaust was a myth. And that's, that's concerning. But to be honest, 4% these days probably represents accurately a kind of fringe. It's a very concerning fringe. It's a large fringe, but it's a fringe. But what scared me more was the 30% who answered they were unsure. And I think our efforts would be well directed to that 30%. There's a minority, a small minority of people who are anti-Semitic and are prejudiced, and their disbelief of the Holocaust, in spite of overwhelming historical evidence, is part of that prejudice. And we may not be able to convince them, but we should be able to educate the 30%.
Also, some of the results from that, there was a lack of awareness around the numbers. I also found interesting looking at it, the correlations. So, for example, there was a really strong correlation between age and awareness. There was a really strong correlation between where people are living, particularly the deciles they're in, and awareness. And I think it would be great to hear from you guys, what are your views on these sorts of correlations that we're seeing? And okay, it's a relatively small sample number, only 1,000 people, but still, I guess it's enough to kind of get a sense.
I guess I would start with always saying what I would tell, because I taught psychology at the same time, correlation does not necessarily equal causation. We do know that, and again, coming from America, you guys call them decile. We call that low socioeconomic. You do see a strong correlation of understanding of the prejudice that happened during that time frame amongst those students, that they get what happened and they understand it on a much better level than someone from a stereotypically be a higher socioeconomic class, because they've gone through those struggles. What struck me the most about it all is that it highlights the need of a cohesive educational component in the New Zealand curriculum about teaching racism, discrimination, Holocaust education, and how that fits into the New Zealand story. So often when I go to a school or I'm talking to people and I say, yes, I'm the education director at the Holocaust Center of New Zealand, I get the, you're the what? Where? We have one of those? And I'm like, yeah, it's been there since 2012. And before that, there was a research center since the 1980s. And people are going, I didn't even know. New Zealand is part of that story, for good and for bad, how New Zealand reacted at the time and what it's done since then. And the only way we can reach the 30% that were unsure, and I would even say the 4% that are that fringe, is through education and getting that story and those the history out there.
Totoko, what Chris said, both about socioeconomic correlations and about the need for education. Good on you, Chris. On the decile, Sally, I'm not sure. I know that the Curia, who produced the poll, drew that out as a correlation. I'm not quite sure the results show that, because if you look into the results proper, it says decile 1 to 3. So the, in theory, the more affluent parts of society had 48% who either knew a reasonable amount or a lot, and deciles 4 to 7 had 39%. So, and that's where Curia found the correlation. But if you go further down into the deciles, deciles 8 to 10 returned a 46%. So I don't think that really shows anything. What the survey does show, I think more convincingly, is a marked difference between older and younger New Zealanders. 57% of, I think, over 60s, and only 18% of the younger age group. I can't remember exactly what the age group was. And that really shows what Chris is saying, that the education system is not getting to children.
So I think we'll talk about education as we move forward. I'd be interested to hear from you, particularly you, Giacomo, who have been teaching in New Zealand for several years now. Although we may not have polls that can tell us whether awareness is declining or increasing, have you noticed anecdotally amongst your student cohorts, for example, if there's been a rise or a decline in knowledge and awareness of the Holocaust?
You know, I'm a little reluctant to. It's so anecdotal, right? My evidence from the classroom is not representative. Also, because I teach people who have already decided to go into tertiary education and to study history. So, you know, they're probably not a representative sample of society. But one thing I have noticed, though, is that I think the Holocaust Center of New Zealand's strategy in offering professional development to New Zealand teachers by helping them get to Yad Vashem, to probably the world's foremost center for education in the Holocaust, which is in Jerusalem, is really paying off. I keep coming across university students who remember being taught case studies around Holocaust education, either in English literature, or in film and media studies, or in history, or in social studies, because their teacher had been exposed to this program. I think that's making a real difference. More generally, I cannot say, but what I think there is no doubt about is that there's an increase in anti-Semitic incidents in New Zealand, which mirrors the increase elsewhere. In some countries, that increase is incredibly marked, in the UK, for example, in France, but also in the US. I think there was an 18% increase from 2018 to 2019. There are statistics about all of this, and I don't think New Zealand is immune to that. And a rise in anti-Semitism almost certainly comes together with a rise in either Holocaust denial or just general ignorance of the Holocaust.
Do we have any idea why we're seeing these trends?
I can speak from what I know historically, that you see anti-Semitism as like it goes in waves, and it's circular. As economics goes up, we tend to see anti-Semitism go down. And as economics goes down, we tend to see a rise in anti-Semitism. And we see also if there's a marked shift in societal views on minorities in general, a rise in anti-Semitism happens. Because usually in Europe and in America, Jews have always been at the forefront of those marked societal shifts, whether it's the right for women to vote, civil rights for minorities, labor movements, things like that. And commonly, that's also associated with economics. And so normally, that's when we see that rise and fall, is depending on what's going on in society at the time. But I think it would be disingenuous to think that that's the only time we see it. Social media especially has completely changed the name of the game. You can go online at any given time and read a post about something that you would think is innocuous. And if it mentions even, you know, oh, George Soros, who's so often quoted about having involvement in everything, that's a veiled anti-Semitic attack, because they're quoting somebody who's a very rich billionaire who's very philanthropic. But what they're really using is an anti-Semitic trope about the government control and media control and, you know, Jews having their hands and everything. And that, I think, is where we are not losing the battle, but where we are finding we have to start shifting our focus is to that online component.
And those tropes that Chris is talking about are incredibly resilient. I mean, they, in some form or another, survive time, right? In some cases, you can trace them back all the way to the Middle Ages, and you see them all the way through evolve and change and then come back. My hunch is that we've seen a rise in the last few years because anti-Semitism has made a leap from what used to be a quite circumscribed right-wing area and has become a little bit more mainstream, has found synergies in particular with anti-Zionism, which is not just amongst the right, but also amongst radical left, for example. And while, you know, criticism of Israel is obviously completely legitimate, there are a couple of ways in which that often seems to me to allow anti-Semitism and anti-Semitic tropes back into the discourse. One is that there is a very distinct inability to distinguish between government and people that doesn't appear consistently in political discussion about most countries. And the second is the assumption that it's legitimate to hold Jewish communities in the diaspora outside of Israel responsible for Israeli policy. I think that's where the anti-Semitic incidents are coming from. And I suspect if you went into the data a little bit more, you would see a direct correlation with the situation in the Middle East.
Yeah, fascinating stuff, isn't it?
Scary stuff.
Scary stuff.
Yeah.
We might have our second song then, which is Never Again, a Song to Remember the Holocaust. And then we'll come back and think more about this question, why? Why is it important that we actually remember it?
They stood in fear, where could they go? They stood so brave, what did they know? On this day, hear us pray, each prayer meant for you. B'yom HaShoah Yikatevu. How could it be the world was blind? Was no one there to make a stand? On this day, hear us pray, our prayers call out to you. B'yom HaShoah Yikatevu. On this day, hear us pray, our prayers call out to you. B'yom HaShoah Yikatevu. never again, never again. Hear our voice tonight, never again, never again. No. The spirit left inspires us all. On this day, hear us pray. The flame still burns for you. B'yom HaShoah Yikatevu. On this day, hear us pray. 6 million prayers for you. B'yom HaShoah Yikatevu. On this day, hear us pray, 6 million prayers for you. B'yom HaShoah Yikatevu.
Tēnā, Speak Up Kōrero here with Sally Carlton, Chris Clancy and Jacqueline Lichner, today talking about Holocaust awareness. Now, the really big question, why? Why is it important that we have an awareness of the Holocaust? Why is it important that we do not forget?
So I think there are three reasons. And the first is the Holocaust and its own historical significance. So as an historical event, even without thinking about relevance into the future, it is a historical event that is a landmark in all sorts of ways. And I'll just pick out one, and that's the invention of the final solution, right? So the Nazis don't invent much through much of their rise and the rise of anti-Semitism and the first legislation against Jews. They're not inventing that much. They're using tropes that are already there. They're evolving them, but they're using pre-existing measures. The ghettos are not an invention of the Nazis. They go all the way back to Venice in the Middle Ages and then across Europe. And certainly economic or cultural prejudice and persecution are not a Nazi invention. Indeed, European countries were implementing anti-Semitic measures in the 1920s before Hitler came to power. Hungary is an example. My own grandfather had to leave Hungary in order to study at university. He had to go to Italy because only some Jews were allowed at university in Hungary. This was before Nazism. But where they move on to something completely unprecedented, which is probably the reason that we now continue to think about the Holocaust as particularly important, is the final solution. And Raoul Hilberg describes the order that Heydrich receives from Himmler in the summer of 1941 as a license to invent. We need to get rid of the Jews. You decide. You do what's necessary. And so the setting of the power and machinery of the nation state towards the destruction of people is really unprecedented. And obviously the use of gas to do it. That's one reason. The other is the nexus with history, both before and after the Second World War. You know, the relationship that the Holocaust intrinsically has with nationalism, with European imperialism, colonialism, you know, the lessons that the European countries learn from the 19th century appear in the Holocaust, and the Holocaust reveals them. And then finally, contemporary relevance, which we can talk about more later.
I think I'd like to just pick up on your second point there around the before and the after. This is a human rights show. The United Nations were birthed as a direct result of the Holocaust. So that would be one of the really, really massive reasons why we need to think about it, because the foundation of our human rights practices and policies today stem from that period in time.
Goodbye.
I always tell people, especially when I'm talking to students, there is really no such thing as history. Because again, if we're saying that it's an event that is done, it's over, it's not affecting us, that's history. When I taught in the States, as Giacomo talked about 19th century nationalism, I used to tell my students I can make a direct correlation and lead you from Napoleon to the death chamber in 1945. And kids would always go, that's just not possible. And as I would draw through them through that timeline, they'd be like, how did we not learn from that? How did we not figure this out? Too often, when we go about our daily lives, we miss that bigger picture. And remembrance and having some sort of educational component or a memorial, it helps us bring us back to that idea of we're only a tiny little part of this picture and of this story. There's so much more going on. And even that one small event can have an effect later down the road. And we have to remember how that's going to affect longer and longer, especially as we get into things like this where we have recordings now. You know, Hitler's speeches, they're always going to be there. We might not want to hear them. We might not want them to get out there, but they're always going to be there. And the only way that we can make sure that they're used in the correct fashion is in an educational setting where people are learning about everything he's saying and what it led to. Otherwise, if they're just hearing it, they're going to attach that importance to it again of, well, he's got some good ideas and we don't want that.
Chris, you touched on it before, this idea of people saying, oh, New Zealand has a Holocaust Center. Why? And I think one thing that would be great to talk about is, why is it relevant to New Zealand? Why does the Holocaust have relevance in a New Zealand context?
That's a great question. People always are surprised at that, of we have a Holocaust Center, thinking New Zealand's not involved. But in reality, New Zealand, just like most Western democracies, was involved from the beginning in actually allowing the Holocaust to happen. You know, the Jews were given basically an ultimatum by Hitler in Germany and Austria and said, you got to go. You can't stay here. And there was a convention held in Avignon, France, to bring together all the world's powers and say, okay, how many are you going to take? Who's going to take them? And while sympathy was expressed from the New Zealand government, they took zero. The same as America and Canada and the UK. This is not a unique issue to New Zealand. I always talk about the Dominican Republic as an example of a really good upstander because they're one of the poorest countries in the Western Hemisphere. And they agreed to take 10,000. And they are a fraction of the size of New Zealand with way less resources. So that's one of the reasons how it relates to New Zealand. New Zealand was involved in the beginning. New Zealand passed laws, immigration laws, limiting how many people could move here. Some of these people came here as refugees. And the cost of them getting to New Zealand wasn't just a monetary cost. It oftentimes came at a very physical and a very personal cost because they're leaving behind everything that they knew, coming here with nothing. And oftentimes it came down to Walter Nash, who was the customs minister at the time, basically saying yes or no. It was his decision to let people in or not based off the immigration law that had been passed in the 1930s. And the Christchurch Refugees Emergency Committee received 150 applications. It's roughly around 250 people, give or take. 30 of them were approved by Walter Nash, and the rest of them were not. We have one that was approved that made it, we think, we hope, to London, but the applicant and his mother-in-law were both ill. They disappeared, and when we looked on Yad Vashem's database of victims, they're listed as victims having been killed, which means that even then, people who got out sometimes were not allowed to stay. They were forced to go back, knowing that they were going back to their death. On the flip side, New Zealand's in the good part of that history because New Zealand is one of six countries that liberated camps. And they're part of the Hall of Honor in the United States Holocaust Museum Memorial. And I think that's also something New Zealand needs to be very proud of, is that they were part of those that liberated camps and helped to stop the genocide. And that makes it very personal. A lot of Kiwis have grandparents or great-grandparents that went to Europe to fight the Nazis, and it's something they should look at with pride.
New Zealand fought against the Nazis, and so it's part of the story. But also, in spite of its immigration policy, it did take in refugees eventually, especially after the war. You know, some people made it here, and they became really integral parts of New Zealand's community, and they helped this country after the war. Amongst them are the people who founded the Holocaust Center of New Zealand. 12 or so former refugees or survivors of the Holocaust. And so it is part of New Zealand's history. Beyond that, I would say, going back to the importance of the event as a whole, its philosophical and historical relevance is so important that it has universal ramifications, including New Zealand. And I wrote in the past about how in the history of the Holocaust, you can hear both echoes and harbingers of dawn raids, for example. So in a country that has an intrinsic interest in the history of racism and the history of discrimination, you know, you can't just pretend that the Holocaust isn't part of that history.
Yeah, very well said. We might have our final song now, which was your choice, Chris. The new ground, Isle of Hope, Isle of Tears. If you could maybe just talk us through why you chose that.
When you talk about refugees, oftentimes it's a story of just utter devastation and sadness. But coming to New Zealand, or in this case, the song is about going to America, you know, it's there's a duality there. You do have that hope. You are leaving. You are going to a place that is going to be a better life for you. And so the refugees that did make it to New Zealand, both before and then after the war, they came here with that hope that they were going to be able to restart their lives. But you also have that sadness of knowing that once you've left, the odds of going back are almost nil. And even today with the refugees that we see around the world, if they leave, they're leaving understanding that the odds of going back are just not going to happen because they're fleeing war, persecution, ethnic or religious tensions. And to me, it speaks to, as Giacomo said, the universal message of the Holocaust.
The Isle you left behind. That Isle of Hunger.
Isle of Hope, Isle of Tears by Celtic Woman. Now, just to finish off, we're going to be thinking about looking forward. How do we ensure that people regain or retain an awareness of the Holocaust? I did note just this week, actually, so in the past few days, Facebook has come out and declared they're going to ban Holocaust denial content. Just having a bit of a giggle over here, which I thought might be a good conversation starter.
I was giggling because I think Giacomo and I both have a very similar opinion based off the look that he had on his face. I mean, yeah, they've done it, which is good, but why has it taken it this long? Mark Zuckerberg himself is Jewish, had family in the Holocaust. So the idea of, well, we won't want to limit free speech, I don't prescribe to that idea. I am very much in the idea of Karl Popper, who was a philosopher who actually was a refugee to New Zealand.
In Christchurch?
In Christchurch. He was a professor at Canterbury University until after the war, when he would move back to UK and then he'd move to Austria. He had this idea of you have to be intolerant of intolerance, because the only way to guard a democracy is to not allow intolerant views that demean or demoralize or dehumanize a sect of your society. Because once you do that, you allow the rise of fascism. You allow the rise of hate and of extremism. And so in my personal view, it's a good thing they did it. It should never have taken them this long. And the excuse of free speech, I think it's just that. It's an excuse. Holocaust denial isn't just an idea. It re-victimizes everyone that was killed. And that is something that we should never have allowed.
I agree with what Chris said, and also with his skepticism. The reason I was kicked when you suggested it is I was thinking, for how long? How long will it take until it gets into a back door or something? But let's not be cynical. I'd like to think, and you guys are broadcasting from Christchurch, I'd like to think that this is perhaps a direct result of the Christchurch call and an increased awareness, in which this country is at the forefront of the real harm, the way that digital hate can become physical hate and have real consequences in the community, regardless of which community. And I think it'll be really interesting to see if and how the incoming government follows up on work that has been done on possibly hate speech legislation. On the idea of free speech, I agree with Chris. And what frustrates me is that these kind of purist arguments around pure and unfettered freedom of speech ignore, either willfully or otherwise, that the freedom of speech is never pure, because access to the means of communication and access to the platforms through which we make our speech heard is not even, is not equal. Until we reach a utopian dream in which there is perfect equality of access, I don't think you can argue that there's perfect freedom of speech. We have to put measures in place to curb our freedoms, as we do with any other number of freedoms, to protect the minorities and to protect the more vulnerable.
it's also something that I think a lot of people don't quite understand when we say you have the freedom of speech or the freedom of movement or the freedom of religion, things like that. It doesn't mean you negate your responsibility. And it also doesn't mean you are free from the consequences of whatever action that leads to. Too often people try to hide behind the, well, I have the freedom. Okay, fine, sure. If you want to have that idea, great. But here's the consequence. And when the consequence doesn't match up to the level of freedom, I think that's where we need to have the, you know, not just Zuckerberg doing what he did, but all social media platforms should be doing this. Snapchat, you know, teenagers are all over Snapchat. Just recently, they had this thing on Snapchat where teens would, I don't know if it was a filter or if it was makeup or if it was both, they'd put on this filter to make them look like they were dead and they were ghosts, and then they would make a soliloquy about how they had been killed in the Holocaust. Whether it was to honor or not, it was incredibly poor taste. And that's an example of free speech gone too far, because that's something you are taking the experience of somebody that's not you and you don't understand and you're cheapening it.
Just to jump in for a second and say that I think experimenting with different forms of expression is okay. I don't want to be chief censor, right? I don't want to tell them you can say this or you can't say that. But there's a difference between looking for different ways of reaching different audiences. And we've just been talking about how important it is to reach different audiences. You know, Chris mentioned TikTok. The example is VR. There was quite a lot of discussion about the Auschwitz experience in virtual reality. And there are plans in the Ukraine of constructing a kind of immersive experience at Babi Yar, the site of the massacre of Kiev's Jews. I want to leave open the door for experimentation. I think it's important. But you draw the line at the expression of hate. That's not about good taste. Actually, it's kind of a violent attack.
I think this probably gets back to what we've been saying right from the beginning around the importance of education. And if people are aware of what actually happened, they're probably less likely to go down that sort of path. We've talked about how important it is to teach people about the Holocaust, and that would be in schools primarily as a starting place. And what's going to be happening as New Zealand history becomes a compulsory part of the curriculum moving forward, and just balancing the international with the local certainly can be done. There's no question around that, but just any comments you've got.
We just launched this year an initiative called Just One Week, and Just One Week offers teachers I guess you can call it a package. It comes with lessons and videos and activities, teacher resources on teaching the Holocaust from that local perspective and bringing in the events of what happened in Europe to why it affected New Zealand through the survivors that we have that came to New Zealand. Because I think that when you start talking about especially those survivors that came here, that automatically makes it local because those survivors bring with them those experiences. And they bring with them everything that they went through, and that influences how they would then go about the rest of their lives. A good example would be Claire Winter. She was from Hungary and, among other camps, survived Auschwitz. Claire's lasting legacy, besides the Holocaust Center and all of the work that she did, is she gifted her violins to the School of Music, Te Koki, at Victoria University of Wellington. That's a very local history. That will continue for time immemorial as long as those violins are played. And so to me, that's how you do it.
I like that. And to pick up your point, Sally, on the balance between local and international, global, I quite like the idea that UNESCO put out actually 3 years ago, and I think maybe New Zealand should have taken notice, that you could use Holocaust history within a broader global citizenship education. I think New Zealanders are global citizens traditionally. They go on their OE and all that, you know, and we have the nation of immigrants and emigrants. So I think it would be interesting to think about teaching Holocaust history within that broader global citizenship education context. At the same time, I'm incredibly upset and concerned by what seems to me an inexplicable kind of provincial turn by the National Library in getting rid of hundreds of thousands of books from their collection simply on the basis that they were published outside of New Zealand. I think 90,000 of those are Holocaust related. But this goes beyond Holocaust education. It's just insane to get rid of those books. The Holocaust books have been saved by the Holocaust Center in Wellington. I'm not sure where we're going to put them, but they're certainly not going to be pulped, which is what would have happened probably otherwise. And I think that's incredibly short-sighted.
Any final thoughts as we conclude our kōrero today?
A final thought would just be that to understand the camps were the end. The camps were not the beginning. The camps weren't the middle part. The camps were the end. It began with small things. Prejudice is the thought and discrimination is the act. And we have to remember that prejudice, if it's not corrected, leads to discrimination. And then that leads eventually to massive attacks on communities, whether it's the Jewish community, the Muslim community, or other minorities, that we can't allow those steps to happen again. Being an upstander doesn't mean always being that person who's getting involved right in the front. It's that person who's also going to events and learning more about things they don't understand and then just discussing it with their friends. Dissemination of information that way is so much more powerful than when you have somebody who's standing in front of you telling you you're wrong. I always tell kids, that's how you do it. You always have to be that person who's just willing to listen and act as a group. You know, there were millions of Germans that were not Nazis. There were so many more that were not than there were. And had they used that power, who knows? Can't say it wouldn't have happened, but maybe it wouldn't have happened as large as it did.
Kia ora, Chris. My final thought is that memory is not enough. I am a little concerned that globally in Holocaust education, we could settle for the United Nations passing legislation that made the 27th of January an International Day of Holocaust Remembrance. That's not enough to convey the significance of the Holocaust. And there's a danger that memory can be hollow and shallow. I like to concentrate on the expression never again and the way that it's often used really out of context and with nothing concrete. Never again, when we say it, needs to be an expectation. It's to be a commitment to preventing the sorts of small steps, the building blocks of discrimination and hatred that Chris was talking about. When it's not like that, when it's just used as a rhetoric figure, then it's not an expectation or even an aspiration. But as Peter Novick wrote in now 20 years ago, just a ritualized reminder of expectations and aspirations that are now tacitly abandoned. And the fact that while committing ourselves as humanity to the remembrance of the Holocaust, states could stand back and watch Rwanda and Bosnia, Kosovo and South Sudan or Darfur reminds us that remembrance is not enough. We got to have action.
Great place to finish up, Giacomo. Thank you very much. Tēnā kōrua. Thank you so much for this really robust discussion, and I really hope that this encourages people to get a bit more engaged with what we've been talking about.
Nā mihi, Sally. Kia ora, Chris.
Thank you.